Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
This is Coast to Coast. I'm Carol Masser. We are here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance and the most interesting stories in global technology from Silicon Valley and beyond, powered by our more than 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries. You can download Coast to Coast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com. You can also listen to our radio show weekdays at 2 p.m. Eastern only on Bloomberg Radio.
Right at the top, but that's where you rank. Honey, your love's better than money in the bank.
Yep, all about the big banks over the last week or so. And shares of Morgan are rallying. Morgan Stanley, that is, rallying as the bank's almost flawless quarter gets a round of applause from investors. Let's get into the results. Laura Keller with us, banking and Wall Street reporter at Bloomberg News in our Bloomberg 1130 studio here in New York. And then joining us on the phone in New York City, Ed Groshans, Senior Vice President and Lead Banking Analyst at Height Capital Markets. Laura, let's start with you. The quarter really solid for Morgan Stanley.
Oh, yeah. Very, very
oh,
much.
Oh, yeah, she says.
You know, and you don't always get to say that, so it's kind of nice. But definitely from, you know, whether it's an investment banking perspective, whether it's a trading perspective, or even if you look at their wealth management side, things were really incredibly good at Morgan Stanley. I think the only thing that we saw that wasn't as stellar as anything else was just the expenses. The analysts had expect them not to be as high as they were. But in terms of investment banking, it was just a real blowout. They really did better than anybody else on the street.
And is it that they did well for Morgan Stanley or just compared to the group?
They do not have the highest fees for the group. And that goes to JP Morgan in terms of investment banking, but they had the biggest growth. But certainly on the equity side, they've kept their crown there on the trading.
Pretty cool. Ed, come on in on this. How do you see the quarter?
I agree with Paul, though. I thought it was a very good quarter. And yes, I guess we have to nitpick on the expenses. That's the one thing that stood out. But they did say that a lot of that was volume driven. So it's not a bad expense. A lot of that volume is driven by client activity, which results in a nice quarter for Morgan Stanley.
Anything that we got, Ed, here that tells you like what's to come from Morgan Stanley? Because I feel like these big banks, I mean, it can vary from quarter to quarter based on the environment, based on, you know, whether or not you made some trades right, whether or not you did some deals.
So I think there's two elements. I think going forward, it looks like investment banking remains strong. There seems to be a good backlog. And so I would anticipate that the performance there continues to be strong. We are coming into the summer months. Trading does slow down a bit. It's going to be tough to beat second quarter earnings or results for trading over the summer months, but I think they're going to try to grind it out and do so. But if anything is going to give me concern, it would be on the trading side of things, not the investment banking side.
How do you see it, Laura?
Yeah, I think that's a good read, Ed, from what I heard on those conference calls. But I'd be curious, and Ed, you know, jumping with your perspective here, some of the themes I was thinking about, you know, when we see these investment banking revenues continue to rise, it's not only the M&A picture that's driving that. So that's where, you know, the banks are going and giving the advice to these companies. But it's also, you see it on the equity capital market side, you know, new stock sales, secondary stock sales. But also there's resilience in the debt capital market side. A lot of people thought that that would wane because, in you know, interest rates have risen. But that really hasn't happened. Now, some of that could be you do have debt deals that happen on the back of M&A. But I'd be curious, Ed, your thoughts on that. You know, is it going to be all of those three things with strength, or will one of those wane in the second half?
You know, I agree with your rising rates. You know, I think what that does is it has a pull forward effect on debt issuances. And so I would anticipate that as we sit here and watch what's happening with the interest rate markets, that debt issuance should be pretty good for the balance of the year. you know, at some point, inflation is going to start weighing in on the 10-year and lift that up. And I think folks want to get, if they have debt that's coming due, get it done today rather than next year when it's higher. And I think that that's one thing that's going to benefit them. On the investment banking and M&A side, and Jamie Dimon said this on J.P. Morgan's call as well, we have a very robust economy right now. And I think, you know, it's going very well here in the U.S. And James Gorman today on his call at Morgan Stanley said that globally they're seeing the strength, and they even highlighted EMEA as one of the areas, the emerging markets,
which have really been beaten up big time.
Right. So it's not just U.S., but we're seeing a global lift. And I think that that's going to benefit all the investment banks, at least in the third quarter and fourth quarter. We'll have to see how next year starts to pan out.
Well, Laura, as you said, you tweeted, okay, I'm coming to the end of my coverage of big banks in this earnings cycle. If you add it all up, what are we learning about not only the sector, but also about maybe the global economy and the global marketplace right now?
The executives were very specific in terms of the economy. Like Ed is saying, they are saying that things are really good. I mean, Jamie Dimon, you know, even when you talk about something like trade wars, you know, where is this tariff going to be coming? How will that impact the banks? Will it be bad? I mean, if you look at someone like Jamie Dimon, he's saying, you know, that's not affecting us now. If anything, he said, it's affecting psyche more than it's affecting the economics. So when you take that picture, there are things that people are worried about, as they often are. But the underpinnings of the economy just are very strong. And you saw that, too, on the consumer side. You know, Bank of America, which did not, by the way, have a good investment banking quarter. They are the only one who didn't. They had a stellar performance in the consumer side. So you really are seeing, you know, people are borrowing. There's not a lot of defaults. Mm. So that kind of place for banks to be is great. You know, you're not having defaults and you're able to get more interest income out of people because rates are rising.
A lot of optimism. Ed, how did you see it in terms of what we heard from the various bank executives and what it tells us kind of about the bigger, broader market environment?
I think there's so – for the second quarter here, what we're really starting to see is a lot of positive trends coming through. Loan growth isn't going gangbusters, but we are seeing a number of institutions start to beat that 2 to 3%. We're starting to see some 4 or 5% growth numbers there. And Laura, you mentioned credit. I mean, credit is just phenomenal. It's just not an issue for the banking industry. And in this environment with a rising rate and loans growing, I think outperformance is the way the sector's going to go. And I think Jamie Dimon's right. It's the psyche. And that's why people are starting to stay away. They're worried about the trade wars. But hopefully we can resolve those and we shall see the financial institutions outperform.
Right before it becomes too much action, starts to impact everything. Folks, thank you so much. Laura Keller, our own Laura Keller, Banking and Wall Street reporter at Bloomberg News in our 1130 studio in New York. Check her out on Twitter at Laura J. Keller. And our thanks to Ed Groshans. He's Senior Vice President, Lead Banking Analyst at Hyde Capital Markets on the phone in New York City.
Oh, worry, worry, worry.
Oh, yeah. We may not be in a financial crisis or crisis of sorts, but, you know, another one will probably come. Among our most read stories on the Bloomberg terminal today, some former Fed officials voicing concern about the next crisis. Let's get into his story. Rich Miller wrote it. He's our economics reporter at Bloomberg News. He's in our Bloomberg 991 studio, in Washington, D.C. So, Rich, what are some folks worried about?
Well, you've got what I like to maybe call the trio of doom.
I like that.
We have a former New York Fed president and Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner, former Federal Reserve Chair Ben Bernanke, and former Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson. And they had a briefing for reporters. Basically, you know, we're 10 years on from the last crisis, and they sort of gave us a little bit of an idea of what their thinking is. And they're a little worried that we might not be as prepared for another crisis as we should be. Yes, there were a lot of reforms put in place after the last crisis. The banks are in a lot better shape. The financial system as a whole is in better shape. There's less less worries about money market funds, for example. But what they're worried about was that because there was a backlash against the bailouts, Congress also took away a lot of the emergency powers that these three guys employed during the last crisis to, you know, to avoid Armageddon. And so, you know, for example, the Fed, which ended up lending money to AIG, you remember them? The big insurance company that was making all sorts of bets not involved in insurance. The new law, the Dodd-Frank law, prohibits the Fed from effectively doing that again. Mm-hmm. And then there are a whole bunch of other things. The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, which was very key in sort of guaranteeing bank debt, is also had limits on that. And the Treasury is limited on and so these guys are worried that if we get, you know, when the proverbial hits the fan next time, mm-hmm. and the current crop of policymakers look into their toolkit, a lot of the tools that were there before are not going to be there, and it's not going to be that easy to get us out.
What's interesting, too, and I feel like there is slowly growing momentum about our growing deficits,
mm-hmm.
and that
yes.
is something that this trio of doom talked about.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. That's a good point. Obviously, when we had the last crisis, you know, Obama came out with this like massive stimulus that included tax cuts, but a lot of spending of about $800 billion. And that helped most economists would say that helped get us out of the very deep recession we're in. But, you know, since then, you know, the debt as U.S. government debt has ballooned, and it's about as a proportion of the economy, it's about double what it was back then. So it might not be that easy to, you know, spend all that money as we did back then.
Wait, I love this stat in your story. These are the kind of things that make me stop and just like sit with it. You're right. Publicly held federal debt now stands at 77% of gross domestic product, double what it was in 2007. So we have a ton more debt.
More debt on the way.
Right. And some of that probably because of the crisis, right? I'm assuming.
Definitely.
But the point is we just did a round of tax cuts. So if we get into trouble, we really can't do that again. Or we're going to be growing debt even more so.
Yeah. I mean, there will probably be – it'll be politically more difficult. It was very difficult for Obama to do that big package. But, it's even more difficult to, you know, add to your credit card when your credit card, you know, balance is double what it was the first time around. And you never know, but, you know, maybe some of our creditors would start saying, boy, these guys are borrowing a lot.
No, but it's interesting. You know, we've had a lot of conversations about – you have too there in our Washington newsroom just about, you know, how the Fed – we kind of want to get back to normal. We want to see the Fed to some extent raise rates somewhat so that if we do – I mean, we live through cycles. We know it. We've all – most of us have lived through ups and downs in terms of our economic cycles and market cycles, that you want the Fed to have some room to lower rates if they need to.
Tim Geithner voiced some concern about that. I mean, the Fed interest right now is, say, roughly 2%, their benchmark rate. And going into the last crisis, you know, they were at 5.25%. And they ended up having to spend all that 5.25% plus go to quantitative easing just to try to help stave off the crisis.
Mm-hmm.
Now they've only got – I mean, if something happened, God forbid, tomorrow, if we had some other – you know, something out of the blue hit us.
Right.
They'd only have, you know, 2 percentage points to cut. But
not a lot of weapons to play with.
No, but Bernanke, I think, put in tried to put a little optimistic gloss and say, it may be bad, but we're not as bad as those other guys. Look at the European Central Bank. Their benchmark interest rate is zero. They've got nowhere to go.
It's all relative. It's all perspective,
right?
And in a crisis, who knows, right? You know, everybody seems to kind of come together ultimately and whether or not we could do that again.
Yeah, I mean, that is a big question given the toxic atmosphere down here. They did come together at the last crisis. But
it's a great story. And as I mentioned, among the most read on the Bloomberg Terminal. Rich Miller, thank you so much. He's our economics reporter at Bloomberg News from our 99.1 studio in Washington.
Don't you want me, baby? Don't you want me?
everybody. Vectra Networks, if you're not familiar with the company, well, you should be, because they use artificial intelligence to check out, detect, and respond to cyber attacks, and they're doing this all in real time. Let's get an update on the company and the possibility of going public. We might get into that. Hitesh Sheth is back with us. He's CEO at Vectra Networks, based in San Jose, California, in our Bloomberg 1130 studio here in New York City. Nice to have you here in studio. Welcome
Great
back.
To be here. Great to be here.
Remind everybody what you guys do specifically.
So we are a company based out of San Jose, California. And we are building software, in essence, that leverages AI to help large customers automate how they hunt for threats.
What are some of the more recent trends you're seeing when it comes to cyber attacks?
You know, one of the areas that we are seeing significant interest in from our customers is how do they address what we internally, in our parlance, called east-west problem in the data center. So what that essentially means is that, you know, you've got a large enterprise that's been hacked. And usually the hacker's intent is not the individual that they're hacking. They really want to get to the core assets yeah. of that enterprise. And those core assets typically reside inside the data center. And so once the hacker makes their way inside the enterprise, they move inside the data center. And in industry parlance, that is known as east-west coverage.
Ah.
And that's a significant gap in most large enterprises that we run across.
And that's where you really get to something that's of importance of to critical, a company
absolutely.
Or entity.
Absolutely. That's where intellectual property tends to reside. That's where financial information tends to reside, et cetera.
Can you – I mean, what's the success rate once somebody's in?
So
this is what you guys do.
Yeah, that's what we do. In the absence of technologies like us – you know, the success of somebody getting to, you know, the IP that they care about is, I would say, north of 75%. It's very, very high, right? Because traditional methodologies simply don't succeed in this regard. There are well-known stats at this point, which
yeah.
is, you know, once the hacker gets in, it takes them like, they have like free reign for like 3 to 6 months. Imagine that.
Yeah, that's a lot of time to play around
exactly.
and create a lot of problems. Hitesh, you know what's interesting too? I feel like, and you kind of kicked it off before we got going, we were talking about some things. We recently did a story in Bloomberg Business Week that looked at Rio Tinto and their operations in China.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately they were attacked or allegedly
correct.
Attacked by the Chinese government.
That's correct.
It's interesting listening to the U.S.-Russian relations
yes.
and the elections. And we're finding it's sovereign entities that are often doing the hacking.
Correct.
This has been going on for a long time. Is it going on a much greater scale than we even realize?
It is. It is. And actually, there are two dimensions to this hacking that are worth noting here, right? I think it is fair to say that every major nation state today, including the United States,
mm-hmm.
Has some form of cyber offense for national security purposes and cyber defense. But what is...
Is it defensive or offensive?
It can be either.
Okay.
It can be either. And we are not unique. I think we would say it's us, yeah. the Chinese, the Russians, Israel, so on and so forth. But what is definitely true is that, unlike the United States, you know, other countries, notably, say, China, participate in the economic version of this. United States is not after stealing anybody's intellectual property.
Right.
Right? We will do this to defend ourselves and protect our interests. But other countries are in the business of actually stealing intellectual property. So when you talk about Rio Tinto in China, right, that is...
It's a fascinating story.
It's all about, you know, economic interests.
Yeah.
And it's economic interests, right? And
yeah.
you see that with China. You see that with Russia. Russia is more complicated for all kinds of other reasons. But, you know, this distinction, I'm not sure, is fully appreciated when people talk about hacking. The difference between national security and economic interests.
Yeah, and you think about, I mean, all of it will have a huge, or could potentially have a huge impact.
It absolutely would. And you know, the interesting thing is that when it comes to economic interests in particular, you know, that affects the average person a lot faster. National security impacts all of us at
right.
the end of the day.
Right.
But economic stuff is going to get to the individual that much quicker than, say, the grand scheme of things of national security.
Are you amazed? Well, this is your world.
Yeah.
But just the amount of, I think, vulnerabilities that seem to be out there and how quickly they've all kind of ramped up?
Yeah, it just multiplies, you know, it almost feels like on a daily basis. Here's an interesting perspective. You know, when you think about crime, just broadly speaking, right? And if you look at crime, say 30 years ago, on a spectrum, for somebody breaking into your house to somebody doing like a major crime, breaking into a bank, the methodology they utilized were, let's say they used a gun to hold somebody up,
yeah.
okay? Today, the weapon of choice, if you want to call it a weapon, increasingly is cyber crimes or cyber methodology. And that is pervasive from very low-end phishing attack on somebody's email to very sophisticated nation-state stuff.
Right.
In their entire spectrum, right, this is now becoming the weapon of choice.
I mean, where is there some, I don't know, D-Day, disaster day because of this?
My personal opinion,
doomsday scenario. I don't like to be so, you know, exaggerated.
Dramatic.
So it's dramatic. But I just do wonder kind of, is the preventive measures like what you guys are doing keeping up with it? Because everybody always says, oh, well, you know, those who want to hack are staying several steps ahead of all of us.
I think the biggest gap, there's a technology gap that people like us help fill.
Yeah.
Right. But there's another gap that is also of note, which is what I would call the mindset gap. And it's very astonishing the number of, whether it's enterprise companies or government agencies, who have a very old school mindset around what technologies to use and the thinking that actually they can stop these things versus recognizing that, yes, it's important to try and stop it, but just understand that the odds are super high that people are going to break through.
Right.
Therefore, what do you have got inside your infrastructure that's going to catch this while they're in flight, if you will, and prevent them from doing the damage they're intended to do? And that mindset gap is really important. To your point about doomsday, the doomsday scenario here that I think I would worry about is somebody crippling our national infrastructure.
Yeah.
Call it the power grids
or something.
Financial systems.
Yeah.
Right. That's the one
terrifies
to worry about.
Me.
That's
like
the thing that I would be worried about the most.
Just got about a minute and a half left here. Because you guys work in the world of artificial intelligence, can you find all the people you need, all the AI engineers that you need to get the work done?
It is a super hard global race
for these workers.
It is super hard. And I can tell you, you know, we have got four R&D centers. San Jose, Austin, Texas, Cambridge, Massachusetts, Dublin, Ireland, right? The reason we're in Dublin, Ireland is, yes, there's great talent there, but it allows us to diversify in terms of where to look for talent. It's very hard to recruit these folks there. And not just, by the way, AI. People who understand cybersecurity, period, are an equally rare breed nowadays as well.
One last question, and we've all just been watching the push by the Chinese and the government to really develop their technology sector and creating kind of mini Silicon Valleys, many of them throughout the country. Should every country kind of have some kind of government support for their technology industries? Just got about 30 seconds.
I wouldn't say government support. I think the best thing the government can do, let's put this in our context, is in many ways to get out of the way. And I think that's our advantage. If we are successful in getting out of the way of our people, of our venture community and the entrepreneurs, that's our best shot versus government intervention.
And they'll do it. So much fun. Thank you so much.
Awesome. Yeah,
come
thank
back,
you.
Come back to New York soon.
We'd love to.
Hitesh Sheth, he's Chief Executive Officer of Vectra Networks, based in San Jose, California, in our Bloomberg 1130 studio in New York City on this Wednesday. You are listening to Bloomberg Markets. I'm Carol Masser, and this is Bloomberg Radio.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. Athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
All right, we want to bring in John Ehrlichman back with us. He's anchor BNN Bloomberg's The Open, correspondent for CTV National News. John joining us from Toronto once again. And John, we've all been talking about Amazon.com, what, their fourth annual Prime Day event. It's come a long way in 4 years, hasn't it?
Boy, has it ever. I mean, I feel like the news cycle this week has been dominated by Donald Trump, Drake, and Amazon Prime. It's like there's no room for anything else because we just keep talking about this. You're right. We've talked a lot over the last couple of days about this Prime Day or 36-hour marathon of spending by Prime users. This is something that started fairly conservatively for Amazon, Carol. You're right. 2015, they still generated a tremendous amount of revenue in a single day, something like 450 million sales based on the estimates. And even though a lot of people saw the headlines about an early challenge for Amazon, they were able to put a very healthy marketing spin on that. I think a lot of people were left with the idea that the demand was so strong that was one of the factors that was creating some challenges for Amazon. And if some of the estimates that are out there, Bloomberg's been citing some industry pundits who believe maybe the goal was for $3.5 billion worth of sales for this event. We're talking about 700% growth over 3 years, which is pretty astounding.
Right, because Amazon doesn't actually release any of the sales figures from Prime Day, correct?
Which is a beautiful thing, I think, for them.
I know. Win-win, right?
Well, you could take the same argument with this Amazon headquarters. Say little, and then get everybody else to do the talking. Get lawmakers in different cities across the country to raise their hand and say why they would love Amazon to locate their headquarters there. And that, in some ways, helps to drive the narrative. I mean, a lot of people are saying Amazon's getting so big that there's a bullseye on the company, and they'll be the capitalism target, if you will, right? But on the other hand, they are the hot team. Yeah, and a lot of people want to be on that hot team, whether it's lawmakers who are looking to locate jobs in their state or whether it's investors who have been clamoring to buy this stock over the last couple of years.
Yeah, interesting. What's also interesting is they had some technical glitches, which is not uncommon.
Sure.
You know, even for a typical retailer or you know, when they've got some kind of promotion, it's not uncommon for the website to either slow down or you can't access it or you have problems with it.
Yeah. I have to wonder how much of that – I'm not here to spin conspiracy theories. I do wonder how much of that ultimately was a win in the end, just creating even more buzz. You know, they had those fail pages with the cute little dogs on them, and they were at the ready with an assortment of pages saying it's hard to load and these cute little dogs, and then it spiraled. And then they said in the end, I mean, they told us in a press release that they sold something like 100 million products. I mean, it's an astounding number, and I think the bigger question now is if you're a Walmart or any of the other retailers like eBay that have been trying to grab some headlines over the last couple of days. How do you do battle with Amazon? And I think, Carol, it's getting to the point, too. I mean, in the world of investment, mm-hmm. everybody now talks about the boardroom question, what would Jeff Bezos do? That was the question we used to ask about Steve Jobs. And it's interesting that in trading today, Amazon's market valuation briefly touched $900 billion. There are a lot of people now who are wondering whether or not Amazon's going to get to that trillion-dollar market cap before Apple does, which would truly be astounding. But the fact that the market cap of Amazon's up more than $600 billion in the last 3 years speaks to that.
Right. Amazon market cap right now, over $894 billion. And let me just look what their revenue is expected to be this year, about $237 billion. And if I look at Apple, their market cap is over $936 billion, and their revenues projected this year for about $262 billion. I mean, they're just kind of neck and neck there. Hey, John, before you go, I want to talk a little bit about Twitter, if we may. Twitter getting their first downgrade in 6 months. And this stock, you know, has had some problems, had some questions, but this year just kind of, you know, full steam ahead, up about 81% this year.
Who knew? Who knew, right, that Twitter was going to be the standout stock coming into 2018?
Nuts.
I mean, I know obviously Donald Trump gets us all on Twitter following where the news is going.
Yeah.
But you're right. The fact that the shares have rallied, I think, something like 50% since late April, resulted in Macquarie saying, time for a breather. And now is crunch time. And we saw it with Netflix earnings this week. Amazon has a pretty good track record of putting together those impressive results, which fuels the stock. Now Twitter's got to deliver. And I think that is a big undertaking for a company that has not seen user growth the same way that we have seen, for example, Facebook consistently grow both their own platform and Instagram. It's going to be a very wild end to tech earnings season because you've got so many these companies fueling the broader market run, and obviously we've talked so much about the NASDAQ outperforming the S&P this year, in part because of this impressive performance from Amazon and Netflix and Facebook, and the list goes on. So earnings season is going to be important for sure.
Twitter, $32 billion market cap, and they're projected to have, John, about $2.9 billion in revenues this year, just for some comparison with Amazon and Apple. John Ehrlichman, terrific. Anchor, BNN Bloomberg's The Open, correspondent for CTV National News, joining us on the phone from Toronto.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I wanna drive.
Just drive, baby.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
Time for the Drive to the Close. Joining us from Westport, Connecticut, Michael Sheldon, Executive Director, Chief Investment Officer at RDM Financial Group. Hey, Michael, nice to have you back here on Bloomberg Radio. What's the most recent investment strategy that you recommended for one of your clients based on this environment?
Well, what we do at RDM, we have a lot of different clients, and they all have different investment objectives. So what we do is we put together investment models, and then we basically run financial plans and figure out, based on clients' investment objectives and their risk tolerance level, basically which of the investment plans they should be in. So, again, we have different models, but I can tell you, broadly speaking, some of the things we're thinking about this year in terms of our investment stance are the U.S. versus overseas. We currently have about 15% in overseas. We were going to add more to that earlier in the year, but we just felt that the U.S. was outperforming other parts of the world.
Mm-hmm.
We're moving towards dividend growth versus dividend yield, given that the Fed's raising interest rates. And the other thing is we're sort of looking at companies and industries that are likely to outperform or stand out in their fields over the next 3 to 5 years. So those are some of the broad strokes we're sort of thinking about. And looking at sectors, we're looking at tech, financials, healthcare. We're still growth over value, and we're keeping a little bit away from consumer staples. Those probably won't perform better until we start to see some slowing in the economy and more of a risk-off environment.
The growth over value stance, Michael, is it because you see the economic momentum that's out here or out there, or is it a case that it's really hard to find value right now, or a little bit of both?
Well, the growth has been outperforming value for several years now, and it seems like that trend is kind of long in the tooth. But the growth stocks that we're looking at, especially in technology, for example, I mean, we are diversified, but the growth stocks that people talk about are actually generating three to four times the overall growth rate of the S&P. So they're really putting up sales numbers and revenue numbers, which make their P.E. ratios and legitimate, really, in this kind of market.
What kind of tech, though? Are you talking, you know, the outrageous, you know, run-ups that we've seen in some of the FANG stocks? Or are you talking more reasonable valuations and tech valuations type names?
It's really a cross-section of stocks. So we own individual stocks. We own ETFs, and we also own actively managed mutual funds. Mm-hmm. So we really own a cross-section of individual stocks. We own some of the FANG stocks, not all of them.
Right.
But these are long-term holdings for the most part, unless something really changes within the companies.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I think we're all trying to figure out where we are in this market cycle, in this economic cycle. Our Dave Wilson had a chart of the day, and basically the takeaway was the 9-year bull market in U.S. stocks has interest rates on its side, and this is according to some research out by CFRA, and they're looking at the Fed's key rate exceeding year-to-year changes in U.S. consumer prices by a certain by 1.25 percentage points before every bear market since the 1960s. This is out by Sam Stovall, and currently the upper end of the Fed funds target rate is at 0.9 point lower than the most recent inflation reading for June. So basically saying we have more room to run, even though we've had a long run-up in equities. You agree that the fundamentals are out there maybe for more gains in stocks?
Well, as we look, I would agree with that. As we look ahead over the next 6 to 9 months or so, the next few quarters, right now we don't see a recession ahead.
Yeah.
So we try and figure out what's going to take the expansion off course. And the big factors out there are the Federal Reserve is raising interest rates. Historically, that's not been a great sign for the markets, but we'll see. They're
right.
Continuing to raise rates because the economy is doing well, importantly. Some sort of geopolitical event, which is really hard to forecast. Some sort of financial crisis, for example, the great credit crisis we had back in 2008. We don't see anything like that right now on the horizon. And then more recently, you have trade wars and trade tariffs, and that's certainly a concern. Over the last 50 years or so, the trend has been towards more free trade, not less free trade. So you have two really sort of strong-willed people in terms of the Chinese leader and Donald Trump, and it's hard to see how that will sort of play out. I think our thinking so far is that ultimately calmer heads will prevail, and the economy will continue to remain on track. But clearly that's a risk we have to keep in mind.
Michael, you talked about 15% overseas. You're going to keep it at that, or might you add to that exposure?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, if you look at the world, the majority of the world's population, companies, and market cap all reside outside the United States. So
right.
There's a real good reason to invest outside or have a significant, a larger percentage of your, or make sure you have enough foreign weighting overseas. We had, for several years, we actually had very little foreign exposure from about 2010 through about 2016, and that turned out to be an astute move. So we added about 15% last year as foreign markets started to improve. There were less fire bells going off overseas, if you will. We may add more foreign to our models at some point, mm-hmm. but we're sort of comfortable right now because the U.S.
Yeah.
economy seems to be leading the world right now.
Yeah, it's interesting. What about emerging markets, which have really been, you know, taking a hit this year? I'm just looking at the MSCI Emerging Markets Index. It's down almost 8% this year. Is it time to maybe consider some of those names, or you'd wait a bit?
We have a little bit of emerging market exposure through ETFs right now, but not a significant amount. With the dollar starting to rise a little bit, it's up about 7% over the past few months, and interest rates rising in the U.S., it's a more challenging time for emerging markets right now. On an absolute basis, if you look at P.E. ratios right now, valuations are not dirt cheap in emerging markets, but on a relative basis, which is important because you have to look at all the relative valuations and where you can invest. On a relative basis, foreign markets and emerging markets do look attractive, but they need some kind of catalyst for us to feel more comfortable about that.
Hey, Michael, you reminded us and reminded our producer that you guys earlier this year had said that this year could be the year of threes, 3% GDP growth, 3% wage growth, and 3% U.S. Treasury bond yields. Not quite there. Could we still hit it? Just quickly.
Yeah, I think there's a good possibility. We're likely to have 3% GDP growth this quarter. 3% wage growth is still a possibility. And we did get over 3% for yields, and we may end the year there. We'll see.
Yeah. What a year it's been. It's only July. Michael Sheldon, thank you so much. Executive Director, Chief Investment Officer, RDM Financial Group, joining us on the phone from Westport, Connecticut.
Thanks for listening to Coast. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com. You can also listen to the radio show weekdays at 2 p.m. Eastern, only on Bloomberg Radio.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.